Congratulations. I'm Kay Howe, and it is April 13th, 2019, in case any of you were confused about that. This is panel number 5503, Traveling with a Purpose. And we have three really good panelists here. You know, it doesn't always work out. These people are really very good, and look forward to hearing them. Most of you know that somebody will be around, in particular this lady, to give you a card if you'd like to ask a question that way. And some of you have the app, which will show up on this screen, and I'll pay attention to that. Because Senator Klobuchar is here, we're being asked to, I'm sorry about this, given the quality of the panelists, we're being asked to quit about 10 or 15 minutes early, since a lot of people want to go over to that. That'll take you a teeny bit of time to get over. So let's begin. We have three panelists. Keith Spruill, who is here to my left, is the director of Abercrombie and Kent Philanthropy, an activity of that well-known and wonderful travel company, which you may not know. They have a mission within the philanthropic area of Abercrombie and Kent to positively impact lives and livelihoods in the areas where they are taking travelers. He's previously been advisor to the World Wildlife Fund in Namibia. Down at the end of the table is Nancy Janis. She's a professor of human development at Everett College in St. Petersburg, Florida, and has been there for 25 years. She's gone from the Peace Corps and in her whole life, starting with the Peace Corps and going to a lot of work with children, among other things, and a lot of work trying to help out with the devastating sexual trafficking going on in the world. She has three daughters, all of them adopted from Colombia when they were teeny people, and she has one grandchild. And Stephen Rubin, who is an associate professor of art, obviously a photographer within that department, at Penn State. He's been a freelance photographic journalist and also a documentarian as a photographer. He's traveled very wisely and wildly and has used his experience and skills to investigate and look at things that are often kept from us by distance and sometimes by indifference. So a really wonderful panel. And I've asked each of them to speak for 5 minutes here at the beginning, and then they can talk among themselves and go to you. And two things I wanted to remind us of. This, the metaphor of travel, is a metaphor that fills all of our cultures. The journey, the quest, the trip, whatever you want to call it, it is something that is part of all of us and all of our cultures. And I wanted to remind you of one wonderful lyric line on this, a line of Yeats, "I will away and go now and go to industry." And on the epic side, this opening line of Dante, which many of you, not even in graduate school in literature, will remember, "In the middle of my life's journey, I found myself in a dark wood." So this journey has been a powerful metaphor for us. And these people have, as they say in the IT trade, instantiated this in their real lives. So we'll start with you, sir. And I've asked them to speak about how they got into this. So many ways of living one's life. How did they choose to live the kind of lives and careers they're doing now?
Good afternoon. It's so nice to see a lot of folks still eager for these topics. This has been a big week. Wow. It is a super pleasure to speak. The theme of sort of inspired travel and tourism with a purpose, for a purpose, I'm going to speak from a particular perspective. There's lots of inspiring stories around the travel experience that individuals have had and our journeys. And usually with a crowd like this, you're all into travel and it's better told over a beer. Can't do that just yet. But what I'd like to do today is speak to how, as a company, as a travel company, we try to facilitate that sense of travel for a purpose. And the sense of purpose that people bring and desire to find in their travel experiences. I very specifically manage a philanthropic outlet. We're a separate registered 501c3 in the United States. We're a registered charity in the UK, registered charity in Australia. We include consciously something about the community in the context of the travel experience as an enhancement for guests to better understand the destinations where we send our guests. Our company is known as sort of breaking new ground, new horizons in a lot of regions of the world. We were often referred to as the go-to if you didn't want to drink the water. So we'd be that safe haven for travel to Africa, Asia, Latin America. We go to the Arctic, the Antarctic. We are a big company. And I've got a very specific mission of managing our giving back to local communities. And what that translates into are investments in education, healthcare, job creation, conservation in these communities. But so travel for a purpose, how does that connect to these investments? And sometimes I want to describe it as the refrigerator memory. That refrigerator is that sacred space in many households where the prom invitation and the report card and the note from grandma or the reminder or the pickup and go. But it's so interesting to me how many families, how many travelers will go to Africa and take thousands of photos of the wildlife. And that's why they thought they were going. And indeed, that's an experience that we strive to deliver. But the photo that makes it onto the refrigerator, that sacred space, is the one of the family visiting that school, or the medical clinic, or the bike shop. I want to tell one little story, an anecdote, about the how side. So this is not going to be as inspirational as Dante and sort of the motivation around purpose, but we, as a how, we want to make a difference. We try to improve positively the lives and livelihoods in the communities where our guests travel. We do that structurally and with strong commitment, multi-year programmatic investments. One of the ways we do that is to try to drill down to the household level. I want to try to make a difference in the homes of the families, in the host communities, traditional stewards of the areas where we're taking our guests. And we do that with bikes. This is a total boulder topic. We take, literally, a container of used mountain bikes, and we'll ship that across to a village outside of where we have one of our lodges. And it can fit between 400 and 420 mountain bikes, and it gets cut up into a literal bike shop. And we identify in advance five women, always women. That's not just playing to the audience, I can tell. But in fact, it's the best way to have a dramatic impact is to give women access to income opportunities. So we train five women in how to repair and maintain the bikes, and the bikes then become their starting capital. And the deal is, ladies, these bikes and the training are your business now. And every bike you sell, set aside a percentage for salary, a percentage for spare parts, business licensing, and set aside a big part to pay for a resupply. I will find you more bikes, but you need to pay for the next container, international shipping, customs, and delivery. I'm not going to play a game that I like to, which is guess how much they have to save. But in your head, think. These are bikes that folks in the U.S. would either end up in the dump or they could hardly sell on Craigslist. What could those be sold for? 3, 2, 1. The answer is they call and they have to have saved $15,000. And it's kind of amazing to me that we could take something that would otherwise end up in the dump, and there's still such value placed. The thing that I really like about this particular program is that they're getting skin in the game, the families that buy a bike. They're using that bike to go to the field to farm, the river to fish, carry water, get to school. Every bike has an impact at that household level. Their skin in the game is they buy it. The ladies are saving enough to pay for their resupply. We've got two bike shops in Zambia, two in Tanzania, one in Botswana, one in Uganda. We tweaked the model for Jordan. We're tweaking it again in Egypt. We're going to be in South Africa by Q4. There are bike shops with five women entrepreneurs that are ferociously proud of their achievements that have resupplied five times. From the guest experience perspective, we're hitting every goal in that type of activity. The impact at the household level, but also they're giving, they have an opportunity to travel through the village with the ladies. So I overspoke, but I wanted to share one very specific how in the context of travel for purpose.
Okay, I'm Nancy Janis, and I'm a college professor. And for me, the most important thing about traveling with a purpose is that I have taken my students from the school, Eckerd College, to many developing countries as a way of exposing them to the global issues that they read about in the newspaper or in their textbooks or what have you. I used to do that a lot, and then back in 2012, I was riding my bike, which didn't come from one of your bike shops, and a lady hit me from behind and kind of changed my life a lot. You can see that I'm now in a wheelchair with hands that don't work anymore. And so I had thought, one of the first thoughts I had once I came to after the accident was, oh my gosh, now I'm not going to be able to travel with students anymore. And so I lived that actually for about 5 or 6 years since the accident, which happened 7 years ago. And then in the fall of 2012, I had the opportunity of teaching on semester at sea. And if you're familiar with that program, we went to 10 different countries, some of which were countries in development. And my husband and I would get off the ship in the port and go around and see all that we could and do all that we could. And it built a level of confidence in me that, you know, what the heck, I'm in a wheelchair, but I can still do it. And so this last January, we have a one-month semester every January called winter term. And so last winter term, I went back to doing what I had done for so many times before, and we took 16 undergraduate students to Cambodia for a course which I called Human Trafficking Field Study Cambodia. I teach a course called Human Trafficking, and I teach another course that's called Global Children's Issues. And so this trip to Cambodia was relevant for students in both those courses, although I had a number of students from other majors as well. The course made me think a lot about travel with a purpose. In this sense, one of the places that we went in Cambodia involved teaching classes at a school. The academic day, the school day for a Cambodian child is only 4 hours. And the people in Cambodia are really very poor, and there's a significant problem of parents selling their children into the sex trades or into child labor, into brick factories and such things. And so there are many programs in Cambodia, NGO programs, that are designed to keep children busy and expanding their learning and so forth. So we had gone to teach at one of these programs to help out really with the English classes and the math classes. And as part of that, I had paid for the program, the NGO, to take us on what they call the village tour. And we did that because it's one thing for me to sit in a white fluorescent roomed classroom and tell my 25 students that parents in Cambodia become so desperate that they sell their children into the sex trades. And it's quite something else for the students to have the opportunity to actually see what desperation looks like. So that's why I arranged for us to do this village tour. And you wouldn't have believed the flack that I got from the students about that. We went and we did the tour, and some of my kids were really vociferous about it. They were furious because they thought that I had taken them to do poverty tourism. And so I had to think a lot about that because, of course, we were, on the one hand, doing poverty tourism by visiting the village. And yet, on the other hand, I was exposing these kids to something that I thought would give them a much greater understanding of the problem that we were studying. What it did for me was cause me to sit back and say, you know, am I a dirty rat doing poverty tourism? And what I came to recognize that my first priority has to be my students, and that the fact that I was exposing them to something that was really important to their understanding about Cambodia won over the idea that I had taken them on a poverty tourism visit. And of course the school gave me lots of excuses, but mostly I debated that back and forth with the undergrads. And I think in some ways that may have been the most powerful lesson for them. So we go when we do these things into Cambodia primarily. I have a real love affair going with Cambodia. And like there are millions of expats there.
I love them.
Do you want me to shut up?
Yes, I
do. Oh, another minute. Oh, okay. I'll talk really fast. There are many expats in Cambodia because they all feel this grabs their heart in the same way it's grabbed mine. And they say, I can't leave, but I always leave, which is always hard. So that's why I take the students. And the more that they can learn about what it's like to live in a very poor country and bring it back to make comparisons with what they're living in this privileged private liberal arts college is so important. And they get it. That's what excites me the most. They get it. They had to make films or write papers or do PowerPoints or something as a final project. And honestly, the ones I remember the best are the films, of course. And every one of those films showed that the kids really got it. And like all those expats I told you about, those kids didn't want to leave. So we all shared that at the airport.
Thank you.
In preparing for this panel, I was realizing I was very much of mixed mind about the topic. And on the one hand, thinking about international travel, the value of international travel, of entering different worlds, different cultures. You know, it's just a great way to break down narrow-mindedness, of bigotry, of prejudice, of having these wonderful cross-cultural experiences. On the other hand, thinking about climate change and carbon footprint, and what about the local, right? So going back to the first hand, right? I mean, I think I've kind of grown up with the idea of, I think there's a quote by Susan Sontag saying, I haven't been everywhere, but it's on my list, right? So just believing and just wanting to do as much as possible. And I think as part of that, I think when I was in college, like way back in the 1900s, I think it was, like, I ended up going to school for 2 years, taking a year off, because I was learning a lot, but I really wanted to go back out into the world, right? I wanted to sort of test some of the things that I was learning. I was studying sociology, and I wanted to see how that might apply to the real world. And I was reading the Greek, philosophers and the Greek plays, and so I, you know, saved all my pennies, went off to Israel, worked in a kibbutz for 6 months, had a kind of extraordinary experience there, but I was there just like more as with a sociologist's head thinking about like how does it work to live in a largely kind of socialist society where everyone is raising everybody's kids and things are not anywhere near as privatized. And so, and then from there I traveled for like another 4 months through parts of Europe, especially with a backpack with, this is in the days of film, so I think I had like 200 rolls of film and maybe a sleeping bag and a tent, and that was what I was traveling with. And so I was hopping ferries and hitchhiking through Europe and stopped for a while in Greece. And I just remember going, looking at a map and figuring out, okay, where can I go that's like the end of the road? And so just looking at the map and choosing a town, not knowing what was there, not knowing anybody who was there, just deciding to catch a bus there and ending up there. Fortunate for me, there happened to be, when I got off the bus and, you know, it's not a place that people would come and go, I just started to try to communicate in my very, very limited Greek, and happened to, some people then ran to get a man in town who had lived in Chicago for a number of years and spoke some English, and so he then started gathering some of the elder men in the community. We sat around the plaza, and there I was at like 20 years old, and there were men who were there who were twice or three or even four times my age, and we sat around in this conversation and we're talking about the ancient Greek philosophers. Right. And talking about the great playwrights, so talking about Plato, and talking about Aristotle, and talking about Sophocles. And it was this extraordinary kind of experience to me to understand for them what it meant for them as contemporary Greeks to have this legacy in their lives, and how they felt about it. And there was clear, enormous pride from them. So that, I think that kind of gave me something of the travel bug, that I then, you know, with all of my roles of film, that whole experience, or that year off, I was kind of surprised I actually went back to college after that because it was so great. But it really turned me into a photographer, made me want to become a photographer. So it was part of the work that I did, then became going down to Chile. This is in the late 80s. It was under a dictatorship of Pinochet, if those of you who may remember that period. And I went down just on my own, not having an assignment, not knowing exactly where I was going, but was able to kind of connect with a group of mothers of the disappeared, and they kind of took me under their wing. And I was there for like 2 days, and they told me about a protest. Right? They told me about a protest that was happening on one street corner. And in Chile at that time under the dictatorship, you could not announce publicly. You wouldn't put up flyers or put up posters saying there's going to be a protest. It was all word of mouth because there were a lot of spies, there was a lot of government repression. So I went to this street corner where I was told it was going to happen and just waited and looked around and didn't see any protest about to happen. I saw a bunch of high school kids all dressed up in like the guys were in sports jackets, right? This is like how Chilean youth have to dress for their schools, and the girls were wearing like skirts. It was all very formal, looked almost as if they belonged to a private school in this country. And they seemed to be hanging out. They didn't seem like protesters at all. Some of them were, you know, like kissing and making out, and I was just like, I'm thinking, like, where is this protest? And then suddenly at 2 o'clock, which was when the protest was called for, these kids with their, you know, sport jackets and skirts suddenly became like radicals hitting the street. Out of their jackets came, you know, spray cans, so they're spray painting anti-government graffiti on the walls and taking garbage and throwing it in the street, creating blockades, lighting them on fire, marching down the street. Well, and doing this, these protests were called relampago. It's like a lightning protest because it has to happen very, very quickly and wrap it up before the police came. This one went on a little bit long. The police came. They arrived with tear gas, with water cannons, and everybody starts to run, right? So I'm running too while I'm trying to photograph. And this whole time, I think like the students are wondering, like, who is this gringo? Because I really didn't have any contact with them up to that point. And I'm running, and they're running, and we're just finally, not knowing where else to go, just like run down to the stairs of the subway. And we're all down there, like catching our breath, that was close, right? And so there was this moment, this moment where we realized, I mean, I think they were suspicious of me, right? So, I mean, who is this guy? Is he a spy? Is he spying on us? But when they understood that I was running with them, I was running from the police, that it's like something happened there. And that's, I think, the thing that has to happen in travel, right? Where you break down your differences, right? And suddenly, it's like breaking bread together, right? You have this common experience, and I think that's the kind of piece that's meaningful travel for me. So I've had those kind of international experiences and worked as a photographer many, many places.
But let me, this is a good story to stop, but we need to stop.
Well, okay, so I'll work into the talk later in a piece about the value of the local. Yeah.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Painful stopping these people. I hate this job. Somebody has asked us a question for both, I think, Keith and Nancy, asking, what is poverty tourism?
It's where you literally travel to the favelas and the poorest areas, the townships, and you either objectively stare out windows of a very luxury vehicle, or you go to experience, but it's much more of an objectification versus allowing those residents to become subjects and people.
Hey Nancy, I wanted to reply in the context of conversation. So your student response to poverty tourism, we face that a lot. And just like your students got vociferous, you can imagine when we've got a New York lawyer who's upset that he got stuck doing something he didn't want, they also are quite vociferous. but the way that we try to break that down, Siem Reap District is still the second poorest district in all of Cambodia, despite the fact that they have Angkor Wat, which is a phenomenal natural heritage, a cultural heritage, site in the world, and gets millions of visitors these days, hundreds of thousands. We try to take the guests into a setting where they can learn and have a deeper understanding of what the real life is, but we found that if we give focus to it by having a project, some relationship that they're being introduced to. So very specifically in Siem Reap, and you just happened to have brought this up, we drill water wells
And I'll tell you specifically, it costs $450 for us to have a drilling rig go out, get out and tap water. We install PVC piping. We do large metal pumps because you get a better flow rate. Pour a concrete base, include a biosand filter. We can do all of that, transform the family's life. We do that in coordination with the Ministry of Rural Development, and we've done over 1,250 water wells. $450 is less than half of what guests are paying per day to travel with us. And I know that sounds, that's our product, so it just is. But it adds to the value of their experience when they go into a village setting, because suddenly they're understanding that their tribal experience is contributing to improving the lives of those guests, and suddenly they become subjects rather than objects. I know that we're going to work together in the future because of the spirit of the way you organize your trips.
Good.
Okay, I've got several questions here that I'll sort of put all together. One was how you traveling on a low budget, nothing fancy, how you pay for that. Another was, for the young traveler going out alone, what do you recommend is a good way to really meet the people in the place that you're visiting? And the third was, what precautions, if any, do you take regarding terrorism threats? So that whole constellation of both cost and safety, and how do you connect with the local people? So let's throw that open.
Is that coming to me?
Any one of you, Nancy, why don't we start with you?
Okay. You know, when I take the students in during the January term, it's nowhere near as inexpensive as it is if I took them outside of the college term. And that frustrates me a whole lot, because I don't know what the college does with the money. I'll give you an example of that. In next month, actually, the end of May, Brian and I have decided that because the January course was so great, that we would take a group of non-Everett-affiliated people, adults and some young people as well, back to relive the same kind of experience that we had with the students. And the price tag for us to do that is about $2,800 for 3 weeks, whereas the price tag for the college students was $5,700 for 3 weeks. So I don't understand that, and I'm not being critical of my school because I don't understand it, but I think making it reasonable is really about looking for reasonable, working hard to make sure that it's reasonable. It's about being flexible about the travel arrangements. Brian and I, in May, because we're going from Florida, are going to be, in order to get the lowest possible airfare, which I was amazed by, $836 round trip, but we have to spend a night in a hotel in the airport in Tokyo. Now, that's what I mean about being flexible. It's like, oh, well, what the heck? One night in an airport in Tokyo to be able to travel for $836 is something we can deal with. And so I think, in terms of that keeping the cost down question, it really is about taking the time to do the research, to, if you're lucky, like I am, I've been to Cambodia so many times that I know which hotels are inexpensive and immaculate at the same time. I don't take people to stay in youth hostels and dormitories and the like. And now I have to even be a little more choosy because I can't walk, so I can't walk up steps and stuff. But nonetheless, it's possible to keep those costs down. I don't remember all the other questions.
I think there were questions about feeling safe traveling.
Oh, okay.
Connecting with people that are traveling alone.
Okay. Oh, that's right. Now I remember them all.
We can spread this out.
Okay. Let me just address the safety matter. Cambodia itself, which just so happens to be the country I'm talking about, is a very safe country. As long as you're not stupid and go walking down dark alleys in the dark by yourself, it's not been a terrorist target. And so I don't feel that it's a dangerous country to be taking young people to. My school doesn't allow me to take students to any country that's on the watch list. So, as an example, I took students to the border with Mexico from Tucson to study border issues a number of years ago, and we went into Nogales, Mexico. Now we can't go there because Mexico is on the watch list. So we go right up to the wall, or to the fence, I guess, and look through it. But I can't take them to lunch in Nogales, for example, to see what life is like down there. So it's a matter of watching the watch list, I guess. The last comment I'll make, and I'd be glad to pass the microphone, is that Brianson, my youngest daughter, is currently studying Spanish in Colombia, where she was born, actually. And she's been very excited recently because the place that she's staying, which is a Spanish immersion hostel, is taking the hostel guests on a tour of a slum in Medellin. And when she first told me about it, my reaction was kind of, poverty tourism. But the point of it is that Colombia has become now such a less dangerous place that they're showing not just, you know, oh God, it's so awful here, but rather, look how we're taking this city by the bootstraps and pulling it up. So I think about that question, you just got to know where you're going.
So I think there are, obviously there are many ways to travel, and I think there are many ways to keep costs down. I think when I was like a young, aspiring photojournalist, I would spend, you know, months before my trip, one, researching where I was going, and two, just eating lots of lentils and rice and beans and just like saving every penny so I could, you know, take it with me and go for as long as I possibly could. I think there are ways to travel where you can go overseas and volunteer. I mean, there are plenty of places you can volunteer and you actually kind of make a daily contribution. But actually places where you can go and work, like there's a worldwide organization of organic farms, and you can go and in exchange for your labor working in a farm, you get free room and board, right? And you have just a very rich experience, and you get to do it basically for, you know, for a week, for 2 weeks, for 3 months, for a year. It really kind of depends on how long you're able to stay. But I want to maybe I can kind of take a turn in terms of, I'm going to segue into the value of local. I think that clearly there's great, wonderful experiences to be found overseas, but I think sometimes those experiences overseas make us realize that the amazing people that you have interactions with, amazing people that you observe internationally, are actually available to you, like in your own community, right? And you're across town in the neighborhood that you never go to, right? And so I think there are ways to look by looking around us and looking in kind of in regional areas that there's benefits to travel. I will say, because also I've made a shift from working as a photographer to now working as a professor and working in the academic environment, and I think there is, unfortunately, a real bias in academia towards the international, right? So if you're a researcher, if you're an artist, in terms of promotion and tenure, they value international accomplishments, right? So if you're exhibiting over in Singapore or in Paris or whatever, that counts big, big, big. And then less so national, and then even less so regional, and then way down at the bottom of the barrel is local. So what happens is that researchers might be going to the southern part of France and doing exciting research about sustainable farming, but meanwhile, 15 miles away from campus are farmers who are struggling with sustainable farming, and there's no connection there, right? So we do need to look around and work locally. So I'll finish up with this. For the assignments I give my photography students, the first assignment we start off with is go photograph a stranger. And not just somebody who's like you, but somebody who's really, really different from you. And of course, you can make that in all sorts of ways. And don't just go take a picture and run. This is not a drive-by shooting, right? You have to come back with a story. You have to have a story about who they are and what their life is about. And then make pictures of them that are not just posed, but actually more documentary in nature. So that's assignment one. Assignment two is go to a place that you feel like you don't belong, however you might measure that. Of course, I immediately say, look, bathrooms are out, so you can't just like go to, you know, shock somebody standing there with a camera as they walk in. But basically go to a place that you don't feel like you ever go or feel like you belong. So I get my students to said this wonderful African-American woman from Philadelphia who went out and photographed this, because I live in rural Pennsylvania, this very white gun rights group that was doing a march in support of gun rights, like completely different from her world. Or somebody, a student who who just doesn't like cars, who believes in bicycles only, and he went to like a garage mechanic and just hung out with in a garage with a bunch of garage mechanics and just learned about their working with cars. But I just think we overlook the local, and it's really important not just to kind of think about always going somewhere else, but actually more like digging where you stand and going deep into that.
If I can tag that one quickly, because there's so many students in the room, questions about cost, questions about security. Very often, the heart and head debate that's taking place, you can translate it into mom is worried about safety, dad is worried about cost. So if you're preparing for the conversation with your parents, I want to really encourage you to just go. Make the decision in your head, and your argument will be so much more convincing. If you decide in your head that you're going to go, and really research the number of visitors that go to a destination, this information is available online, and you look at the percentage that are actually having some kind of issue, whatever that might be, as long as you carry street smarts, there's very little chance that you're going to be part of those odds. But even if you're staying in the hostels of destinations, the threat concern is so overblown in the press relative to numbers. Spend a bit of time looking at the numbers. In terms of cost, you have zero excuse this generation. The rest of us all travel with books. Europe on $25 a day, and we would cut out chapters and throw them away. And you guys have apps. You can use Traveling Spoon and go have an amazing dinner with families that have said they'll teach you how to cook, and then you sit down and enjoy the dinner with them. It's only a few bucks more than going to a restaurant. You've got Airbnb. You've got all the travel profiles. Everything's available to you. There's zero reason why you can't figure out, with a little bit of effort, how to travel cheaply. Put down a few numbers. Show Dad your spreadsheet. Spend the time. You'll get them both on your side. But really, the biggest barrier is going to be inside your own head. And once you get past that, you'll be able to convince the folks to love you.
All right, there are a series of questions here very specific for each of the panelists. Keith, you have hit the bicycle caucus in water. So we would like to know.
Yeah, play to the audience.
You're playing to the audience. How do you source your bikes? Sounds like you need hundreds. What do people do in the target countries to get spare parts, change tubes, tires, etc.? Very specific question. From where do the bicycle parts come? Local industry, abroad? All of that.
Okay, I'll answer quickly. This is getting a little bit into the weeds. We get them from organizations that are rooted in communities these crazy Boulderites that have infiltrated Chicago and LA and these places that advocate for alternative transport, and they collect bikes. They collect them from the police department, from the universities, from people that leave them behind. Folks drop them off, and when they understand what we're doing with them, they offer. And so, yes, we ship a lot of bikes, about 3,000 a year at this stage, and that number is going up. There's a lot of packing that has to take place. We spend a lot of time on the logistics of it. The actual parts issue is one that we can never quite get past. So the best we can do is the ladies steal parts from other bikes. And so they're poaching from one to fix another.
Their own bikes.
Yeah. Their own bikes. Yeah. Maybe they're not. From the bikes in their bike shop. Yes. We do throw a heck of a lot of tires in there. Interestingly, they always ask for more tools and helmets. They want more helmets. I think that answers some of it. I'm happy to talk with whomever was really into it afterward.
All right, and here for Stephen, will drone two of them? Will drone photography be accepted in other countries? And how safe is all of your equipment while traveling to other places?
I wish I knew the answer to the drone question. I really don't. I don't. I haven't worked with a drone. I know I have friends who do, but I'm afraid it's all been domestic. So I think you can. You can probably get away with a lot now. It's still relatively early in terms of controls. But I think you may just... one of the things I've done is just quickly, sometimes when you go into a country, you don't even... I once had an assignment in Pakistan, just got the day before, landed, didn't really know where to go, dropped my stuff at a hotel, asked the taxi driver, take me to the local newspaper. I went to the local newspaper, walked into the photo department and asked, okay, what's going on? They just, you know, five minutes later, I was on the back of their motorcycle going to this rally of Benazir Bhutto with 100,000 people. But I think, like, those are the people that you can reach out to and kind of try to find local photographers. They will probably know the answer. Maybe because there's a way to do it by internet in advance. The second question was equipment, safety and security. You know, there's always a risk. I just think you kind of have good, solid camera straps. Keep a close eye on your equipment. You know, you kind of develop a certain kind of sense for people. I think also you just sort of have to try to not show fear, even if you feel it inside. Like if you're feeling it, like you're in a kind of unsafe place, you just try not to show that and keep it in until later.
And Nancy, do you find that ADA access varies tremendously in different countries and regions? Have you been able to influence better access to some areas by speaking with local officials?
I missed the very first word you said, something how, access.
Yeah, ADA access. Do you find how it varies in other countries and regions and how you deal with that?
Okay. The ADA access in other countries and regions is terrible. And yet I've found ways to deal with it. I'll give you some examples. I hope this answers the question. We've chosen hotels, for example, where there are elevators. That begins to address the problem. Now, sometimes those elevators run to a basement and there'll be like a driveway down to the basement. And so the people recognize that they have to help in that way. And the kinds of things that have been most problematic to me, both when we did semester at sea and in Cambodia, is that I can't go climb into a bus. You know, in developing countries, they don't have those nice buses that kneel and send out a ramp or a platform for a wheelchair. So I bought a sling, and I'm like, a bag of cement on the trip. This last January, Brian and a number of students would grab a hold of this sling, and I'd be in the sling smiling and trying to be happy while they would carry me up the steps. The same thing when we were on semesters at sea, we didn't have the sling. And so then I would have boys at the top end and Brian at the feet end or whatever, getting me up into buses. And, you know, I've never been so felt all over by college students. But I think that you have to be sunny about that stuff. And so I stay sunny, and I figure this is the price of travel. Now, did that answer the question?
Well, here we have some questions from people who are worrying. People are worrying about a lot of things. One is, how important is medical and evacuation insurance, and do you have recommendations? And another is, do you worry about resistant TB, HIV, or other diseases in traveling?
Open to
any of you. They're not worried about it.
We, as a company, is a tremendous liability, and so insurance is a priori, and I would encourage anyone, regardless of your budget, to get evacuation insurance. If something really dire happens, the cost for the evacuation insurance is not too much relative to what you're going to need. And they're very responsive. They've got 24/7. They're going to basically assess where you are, and they're going to look at resource for medical support and say, we're either flying you out or we're going to get you where you need to go to a top-tier Western standard support. And so I would strongly recommend that for everyone. In terms of the specifics of medical issues, disease concerns in very specific locations, again, there's so much more information available online than there ever used to be. And so going to the World Health Organization, going to the specific State Department guidelines. The other thing I want to recommend, even for the budget travelers, is contact a really nice travel company as if you were a buyer and ask for a proposal. They're going to send it to you. and they'll include some of the medical background, and you can get their perspective on what the recommended, you know, precautions are going to be. But you'll also get their insights on how to organize an itinerary without having to pay. So I'm giving away trade secrets.
Centers for Disease Control has a website that you can go to.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff online that people can. We only have time. I'm sorry. Maybe two or three more questions. One of them, here's someone starting a new career that all of you could answer. These are such good questions. I'm sorry we can't get to them all. Any recommendation for someone looking to start a travel impact venture agency and as an encore career? They have no idea. Okay.
That would be really a jerk. That's an awesome idea. I will say that in the context of travel impact, you joining into the mainstream of the travel industry, I mean, there's established sort of business procedures and price points and ways to market yourself. Impact and the desire for impact is a market segment. It's not everyone's desire when they travel. I mean, the vast majority of travelers are, you know, drop and flop folks. They put their sandals on and drop on the beach and hang out, or go to Disney. So you're going after a little bit of rarefied air if you're only specifically looking at impact travel. So my strong encouragement would be think about the market segment and what exactly would be your value proposition relative to that segment.
I think that. I have to be clear with the students about how much impact they're likely to have. You know, I did a research project a number of years ago on short-term service trips abroad. And it's quite common for faculty to take students or church groups to take students, for example, to work in orphanages in different countries. And in actuality, that unintentionally can be not only non-impactful, it can be hurtful because the children grow attached to the workers and then after 5 days the workers are gone. And so I think that in terms of the impact question, I think that you have to really think hard about whether or not the people that you're going to take on your impact heavy trip are going to make an impact or not, and what the impact that you would hope that they would make is, and how much they actually are going to expect that they're able to do. I try to be very clear with that, about that with the students that I travel with. I also really want to answer that last question, which is that I tell my students right from the beginning, don't get drunk in Cambodia. That's where we're going. I say, don't get drunk in Cambodia because it's not safe. And along with that, I would say, don't sleep with people in Cambodia for the same reason, because it wouldn't be safe. And we had no problems at all with our group in January doing dangerous things while we were in Cambodia.
Totally. I really support your perspective on the value of volunteerism as the broad topic there. Again, students, we've had a lot of questions around wanting to go across. Mission work, if it's sort of a religious organization that you're traveling with, then the purpose is not necessarily to make a difference by painting a building, but it's to share in your religious expression. And that's fantastic. So mission, I want to categorize as something very different. Orphanages have become a business in Asia. These are OVCs. These are not necessarily orphans in our classic definition. They might be vulnerable children, or they might just be there because the person running the orphanage is paying the parents to give the Western visitor the chance to hold babies. And that's sick. And I say that very raw. And so there's a child safe certification effort. Whoever you travel with, look to make sure, especially in Asia, that they're child safe certified. You don't want to be part of the problem in going to those types of settings. Let me tell you how we do it. We don't go to orphanages, period. We do support and invest a lot into schools and into school learning environments. There are still companies that will have videos of the Western visitors lined up in chairs and all 300 kids out there doing a song and dance. Equally disgusting. That's just not the way you want to travel, right? You don't want to disrupt the kids' entire school day and make them into performers for your vacation experience. Where we have tried to transition is to ambassadors. These are some of the older kids at a school that come out, and they meet you, they introduce themselves, you go for a walk through the property with them, you're able to ask direct questions. It didn't reduce the guest experience whatsoever to be introduced to a student and having a walk and talk and share a Coke or a cup of tea with a student versus having the whole darn, you know, assembly out there in front dancing for you.
Here are a couple of specific ones, and if people want to leave for the Chloe Charlotte show, please feel free to. I know a lot of you do. Let's do just one more, and that's any recommendations for travel in China in particular.
I don't feel like I can answer that very intelligently, although I've been to China on several occasions, and when we were on semester at sea, we went to China. I've not seen travel difficulties in China, and I have seen fabulous things. When we were on semester at sea, one of the things I had to do as a professor was arrange a field class in a port that related to the topic of my class, and I happened to be teaching lifespan development. And so you're probably aware that there is a growing elder class in China, and that the tradition of the children taking care of their parents has changed very much as the Chinese economy has changed. Young people are moving to the cities, and their old parents are staying behind in the country. And so I wanted to study the elderly in China, and we went, it was fabulous. We went to a park where the Chinese are out at 8 o'clock in the morning, ballroom dancing to radios in the park, and playing different kind of martial arts activities, and it was wonderful to see that. And so I can't answer about dangers traveling in China because I haven't encountered them. And it's a really pretty fascinating country.
Just a few little tidbits to travel to China. It's wonderful because not everyone's going to speak English. Like so many destinations today, you're going to have frustrations. But that's awesome. That's a fun part of travel. A strong suggestion that depending on your vacation experience, you might want to schedule a nice hotel every third, fourth, fifth night. Especially if you go on budget, squatters are hell on the knees. You want a toilet? Not everyone understood that. and expect that the humanity is going to be a part of the experience. It's very rare to get past the density of people. And so, you know, in the context of travel, some folks want the isolation. Probably not a good idea to go to China.
I want to thank this really wonderful panel for all of us. And Michael, you have some very good questions, some of which go unanswered. For example, how to make money traveling. Be careful is what we heard here. Thank you all very much.